Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today, we're beginning a series of episodes with the WET Center at Fresno State. WET stands for Water, Energy, and Technology. The WET Center's mission is to empower Central Valley's core industries by providing access to cutting-edge resources, innovative research, and industry expertise, driving sustainable growth and regional prosperity. They have supported amazing startups and companies around the world right from our own backyard. Our first episode is featuring Ken Camarco. Ken has spent his career in all facets of global manufacturing, energy, operations, supply chain, information technology, and management. He is currently the president of D-Max Plasma, a company that utilizes plasma technology to attack contaminants in our water supply, something that has never been more pressing in today's world. Let's go meet Ken, and Baker will take us there. Blessed to infiltrate the pod waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best! Fresno's best! To start off, Ken, were you a tinkerer as a kid?
I was, definitely. I'm one of those people that, as I've even grown up, I often describe myself as somebody that likes to build things. And that could be things, or it can be people, or organizations, or processes. So very much have been an inventor most of my life.
Yeah, I think it's an integral part of our country's history. I just recently read that Walter Isaacson biography of Benjamin Franklin, and I've been thinking about the tinkering economy. And it's one of those things where I just wonder, as technology gets more complicated, more advanced, and specialization reigns king, if that tinkering culture is something that can still exist in some ways. And I think it can, but obviously there's challenges. I'm curious, for you, your educational experience growing up, did that help hinder neutral as it relates to tinkering and your entrepreneurial spirit? Was there a place for that in your education experience?
First, I'll go back to the question, the observation that you made, does it still exist? And I can only say through my own experiences, I think very much it still exists, because there's people that know me and know the things that I do and have done that come to me constantly now with their idea and their invention and wanting to bring it to market and thinking about it. So I do think that it's an active thing, and it's across all generations. And certainly being a part of the WET Lab and the WET Center, it's been interesting to be introduced to all these other new technologies and all these different fields. As far as my own education, I think it was both the formal education, certainly through school, and there was very much the experiential learning, shop classes, drafting, some of the other things that were afforded to us, but at home as well, different generations certainly, but we worked on things. You made them last. And my father certainly had some tools, workshops, was in construction. I was introduced to it, and I was around it for much of my life, building things. He was in road construction, but certainly you kept cars and trucks and everything else moving. Yeah, you were always working on something.
Yeah, I had a chance to look through your past experiences through your LinkedIn pages and other places, and you've worked in a diverse array of industries and in different capacities. If you were to summarize a through line for you in terms of your professional career, how would you summarize it, starting from where you were with Cooper Industries to where you are now?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've always appreciated about my background a little bit was always being on the cusp of firsts, even at Clarkson University. When I started with there, they were first introducing what was called semester in industry, and now known pretty much collectively across the nation as co-ops or internships, in order to get exposure to different things. But it was a semester in industry where you take an entire semester and really apply the knowledge that you're learning in the classroom to real life experiences. And when I started with Cooper Industries, they had just started a management development program. So that was a first. And then when I got into Cooper Industries and was first relocated to a division they had in Dayton, Ohio, they were introducing automation. And They used to have a little phrase, don't hesitate, automate, right? Because it was the first opportunity to start introducing computer technology to the manufacturing floor. So we were putting in automated storage and retrieval systems based on IBM XTs and ATs, which people don't even know now, but those were 5 megabyte hard drives, right? A picture that you take today is larger than what the entire hard drive had the capability of doing. And we're spinning carousels and picking parts and the like, and put in tool tracking systems and computer-aided design for the first time and computer-aided manufacturing. So we're going from art to part in a day. And these were all like revolutionary things, and it became known as computer integrated manufacturing. So these were all firsts. And one thing leads to the other, where you start having an affinity for understanding new technologies, applying them for business benefit, which was a big difference, right? It wasn't just to put it in place, but it was actually to generate a value to the organization from it, which typically means bottom line earnings impact. So that's through productivity in some form or another. And I got recognized for doing that and started being promoted into information technology, which was new at the time, and started putting in full automated systems for the entire business. And so that took me down a work stream into lean manufacturing and application of business systems for, again, business benefit and applications such as SAP, Oracle databases, relational databases, and being able to communicate those same technologies and benefits throughout an organization that had never been exposed to any of them. You're taking some of the virtual world into the physical world and showing them how they apply and teaching these concepts to people that were, quite frankly, afraid of technology at the time.
Yeah. I want to jump into kind of the meat of our conversation, which is about your latest venture. And I want to start with Forever Chemicals. I'm hesitant to even say the technical word because I think I'm going to pronounce it incorrectly. But can you explain what Forever Chemicals are and then what we know from the scientific literature about the effects on our bodies?
I'll do my best as well. The acronym, if you will, PFAS, PFAS, stands for an entire group of chemical compounds known as per- and polyfluoroalkyl alkaline substances. So it's a real mouthful, but they became known as forever chemicals because they are very difficult to break down. And they were obviously known as not being able to be broken down, and the fact that they also bioaccumulate in the environment and in each of us individually as human beings. It's another one of those technologies that started out as a benefit, right? These are compounds that scientists, chemists created to do some really good things for a lot of products. It's at the advent of non-stick surfaces, right? So you think in terms of Teflon, you think in terms of anti-stain and wind-resistant clothing. Those are all built off of PFAS compounds. All right. Firefighting foam, also known as aqueous film-forming foam or AFFF, was a PFAS derivative. So a lot of these great things and great products were enhanced by PFAS. And as we know now through the ages, we don't always understand what the long-term impacts of some of these things will do or what they will ultimately become. And in the case of PFAS, it was learned back, you could argue, in the 1960s, even the 1950s, that some of the innovators in the space, 3M, DuPont, and the like, did know that there were harmful impacts from these chemicals and hid them because they didn't know the full effects of them. And then later, in 1970s time frame, they understood that it actually bioaccumulated into our bodies. And again, to make it very conversational. Bioaccumulate simply means that it doesn't go away. You don't excrete it in any fashion, and it doesn't break down. In the 80s, they started linking PFAS to cancers in humans and in animals. And it wasn't until really 1999 that the first lawsuits were filed against DuPont by a lawyer out of Cincinnati on behalf of a farmer in West Virginia, where his cattle were dying outside on fields just downstream
did
from
you
a DuPont facility.
Sorry to interrupt you, Ken, but did you watch the Mark Ruffalo film Dark Waters with the
Teflon? I did. What
did you think of it? Did you think that was an accurate representation?
Based on everything I know, it was very accurate. From a theatrical perspective, I thought it was a little slow moving. It wasn't as embracing as Aaron Brockovich or something along those lines, but it did tell the story. It's at an excruciatingly slow pace. But ultimately, and what I think it did depict is how long it even took for that to work its way through the legal system and for people to believe. And when you know now that all of that documentation and history existed in these companies that recognized the harmful effects since the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and you can only say the cover-ups that did exist. And now, of course, as we fast forward, we're here in 2024, these same companies have either lost or settled lawsuits in the tens of billions of dollars individually. And we are here as citizens of the world living with the environment that was created by those products.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about how governments have tried to address this? I know there's been some upstream and downstream approaches. I'm familiar with the Biden administration's move in April. It was announced in April to try and address this problem. Like, how are governments and other organizations, before we get into the plasma technology, how have they tried to deal with this issue?
I think it's, if I will, it's slow, but it's a standard process where every, if you will, constituency has an opportunity to comment and make their case for whether or not it truly is harmful, how harmful it is, what the effects are, how far-reaching those effects are. And in the United States, with our Environmental Protection Agency, at a federal level, they look at that and they've been studying it for probably 25 some odd years. And the way that we are organized as the United States, states have the opportunity to do regulations on their own behalf, awaiting, if you will, federal promulgation of regulations and standards. In this regard, many states, forward-looking, certainly the coasts, both the East and the West Coast, moved first and started implementing some standards and regulations for compliance about the downstream effects of PFAS. So that was looking at water standards in particular, and always, first and foremost, trying to protect us as citizens. In April of 2024, the EPA finally promulgated regulations regarding many of the compounds and certifying, or excuse me, designating two of them in particular as hazardous under CERCLA designation. So they have to be treated as a hazardous chemical, and that's PFOA and PFOS. Now, what it also says is that they have 5 years, particularly in the water and the municipal water supply has 5 years to do something about it. So it took them 25 years or later for the EPA to do something, and then they give them another 5 years to then comply with what those regulations and standards are. And if history follows, they'll move that upstream to the emissions side, right? Because there are still processes, industrial processes that create PFAS, and they then can enter into the environment. So those will have to be regulated as well at some point. But this is really the easiest way, I think, for folks to wrap their head around it. It's today's modern day asbestos problem, although many would argue much larger. And it doesn't affect just the United States. It's a global issue. And Europe, Australia, they've already promulgated standards. Asia's looking at it as well. So, this is truly a huge problem affecting the entire world.
Okay. Before we get into your product specifically, can you talk a little bit about the marketplace prior to your entering into it? What were some of the approaches before you to address some of these chemicals? And then we're going to spend some time talking about exactly how your technology differs and tries to address the problem.
Sure. If you think in terms of all of the usual approaches were taken towards destruction of PFAS or sequestration of PFAS, so those would be your filtration, purification, separation technologies. It could be ultraviolet light, it could be other chemicals to break it down. In many regards, they would use granular activated carbon, which is a carbon filter to sequester PFAS, and that's still largely in use today. Micro or ultra filtration, nanofiltration are all been applied to capture the PFAS and separate it from the water stream. Of course, that then puts it into a different container, right? It puts it into carbon or puts it into a filtration element, a media. So what do you do with that? When they found that they couldn't break it down through other chemical means or UV alone, and you just sequester it, they either have to then incinerate those th same containers. They found that the PFAS would then become airborne, and in many regards, most places would regulate out that impact. So a lot of this lands in landfills. And then the current application is landfill leachates, right? Because everything is in a landfill. And then we have to, at some point, treat the leachate that then has PFAS in it as well. It's an insidious cycle. If you think about it, everything landing in a landfill that has PFAS in it, all the pots, the pans, the clothing, these filters, the GAC, et cetera. Let's put it in there. Some of the other aspects of it, and still employed today, much like any other hazardous chemical, can also be deep well injected, much spent uranium. So we then kick it down the road, right, generationally, and just put it into the earth at a deeper level.
And I'm sure that gets into aquifers, and then you've got groundwater, and it seems like it's just, yeah, it's a maybe a short-term solution with long-term problems. Can you break us down, really unpack for us, what is the technology at DMX Plasma? Like, what, how is it approaching the problem using a different method?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. So, plasma technology, many people know it's used in TVs, it's used in surface treatments. It's known as the fourth state of matter, right? From solid, liquid, gas, plasma, right? So, you're basically boiling gas and creating plasma. In day-to-day applications, as I mentioned, it's applied in TV screens now replaced by LED, but the ones that we can immediately see with our eyes are neon and a neon sign. That's a form of plasma. Fluorescent light bulbs, that's a form of plasma. And of course, the one that we live with on a daily basis is simply environmental lightning. And what we do here at DMAX Plasma is we create plasma by literally creating lightning on the surface of the water. So if we visualize creating that aura, we go from very simple 240 volt AC line power, convert it to 30 kilovolts of DC energy, and we pulse that in an argon gas environment on the top of the water, and that creates lightning or plasma. And the plasma energy has been found to be very effective at breaking the carbon fluoride bonds that make up PFAS compounds. So it sounds a little bit more complex than it maybe it is or needs to be. And then we actually bubble the water using the argon gas as a transport mechanism. And PFAS is surfactant-like, which means it's like soap. So we create bubbles, and the PFAS adsorb or connect to the surface of the bubble and are transported to that plasma interface where the lightning is. And that's where we're able to break the carbon fluoride chains.
I thought you explained it perfectly clearly. I feel like I have a better grasp after listening. The things that have come up in just looking into the technology and a lot of technologies that are addressing forever chemicals is about the cost and the byproducts. So how do you think about those, as particularly as a lot of state, let's say subnational governments are thinking about ways to implement this and they're thinking about costs and byproducts. How does that relate to what you're doing?
Yeah, that's a super question first and foremost, but that is really where it plays to the strength of the plasma technology because we do not use anything but organic, if you will, in our process recipe. The plasma alone will break the majority of the PFAS long chain compounds. When we go to the shorter chain compounds that are in those, they're a little bit more hydrophilic, which means that they want to stay in solution and not necessarily travel to the surface. So we inject a organic surfactant to aid the bubble process and add that adsorption for those shorter chains. The only thing that we're creating is the mineralization of carbon and fluoride and of those organic surfactants that we include. There are no other byproducts. And to put the energy in perspective, one of our plasma generating networks, it sounds like a lot, like 30 kilovolts, but it's only 240 volt line voltage. And if you think in terms of one reactor and a plasma generating network, it's equivalent to a microwave oven in your house, about 1500 watts. So we're very low energy on the order of removal to some of the comparative technologies that we're up against or are also addressing the problem. And they have their place as well. I don't mean to dismiss them. They're very effective, but they're typically more effective in super high concentrations and short and smaller batch sizes.
Okay. Now, in looking at some of your products, you delineated between a more modular and mobile system and then more permanent installations. Explain for us who that's designed for. Is that designed for different scale governments or municipal water facilities that you're going to be working with? Or what's the kind of logic here? And is there a consumer-facing aspect to this product, or is this primarily going to be vis-a-vis government contracts or working with large-scale companies that are trying to address water issues?
Yeah, so that's a big question, and it's going to take me a little bit to unpack that. But
Okay.
the flexibility of our system is that it can scale up or scale down. So if you think in terms of the dimensions of PFAS concentration and the volume of that concentration that needs to be treated, so thinking in terms of gallons per minute, there's different applications that may be at a very low concentration in a very high volume, thinking municipal water supply, right? It's already very diluted because of the quantity that's moving through it, but it still carries PFAS, and as we know, it bioaccumulates, so it needs to be treated. In some of those huge systems, you're talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of gallons per minute that need to be treated to address a municipal water supply. In those cases, there's existing technologies that can separate the PFAS out of that large body of water stream, sequester it into smaller quantities that we can then treat in a lower quantity, a little bit higher concentration. They call that a treatment train, right? Where you basically have multiple stages of different treatment technologies. Where we may be at either the front of that train or at the back of that train to aid in the process where we do the destruction of it. So we don't just sequester it or separate it, we destroy it. In some other cases, other applications we discussed before, landfill leachates, the volumes are not as great, on a throughput level, and the concentrations can vary, but we can normally treat those on a standalone basis where we're just at a installation, we can move on site. If it's a particular well, if it's a particular landfill site, and similarly, industrial wastewater streams, so treating at the source, lower volumes of output, different variations of concentration, we can typically do that on a standalone basis. So we like to think of ourselves as, and our technology more as a Lego box that can scale up or scale down or complement treatment trains. So we're very flexible for all these different applications, be it stormwater, landfill leachates, AFFF treatment, industrial wastewater streams, wherever it may be, we believe we have a solution to address that.
Okay. I want to take a step back and talk about behind operations and thinking about articulating new technology. Because you, as you said at the beginning, you've been involved with technology at its cutting edge. And part of the challenge with new technology is explaining it to people. I'm reading a book right now that's trying, and I'll admit I'm struggling. It looks at some of the math behind the artificial intelligence and chatbots that we're seeing. And I'm wading through very slowly. And the person writing is very articulate, but still it's a challenge for me to comprehend what he's talking about. How would you think about if you were working with another founder that's working in a highly technical space, and they were asking for advice about communicating, not only with the broader public, but maybe with potential investors, where you're having to really articulate something to a room full of people that hear a lot of pitches and have to comprehend things quickly, but also understand applications almost immediately so they can understand whether it's viable as a business product. So can you, do you have some general advice about how to approach communication?
Certainly, I think that there's always the comparative or the visualization, trying to put it in terms that they can understand or relate to as something that was similar that they evolved into. So something that was new to them in the past that took them a while to grasp and then ultimately got their head around, if you will. When we talk about the scale of the PFAS problem, we say it's like the asbestos problem. It's everywhere. It's in all those things. It took a long time to get there, right? It gets into your body. It causes cancer. When you look at the technologies, what can we think in terms of and how can we explain it in a simplified version of it? So we say we're creating lightning. Lightning's a lot of high electricity. You can understand that it's blasting something apart. I always appreciated engineers that explained to me the theory of a jet engine and broke it down in terms of suck, squeeze, bang, blow. That's what happens. That's how a jet engine works, right? It sucks in air, it squeezes it, it creates combustion and blows it out the back end. I got it, right? I get it. That's how you do it. So it takes a little bit, I think, when you are confronted with a new technology to say, what is that hook? How can I wrap it head? And sometimes it's simply repetition. I know for us in plasma, no matter how many times we communicate that it's really low energy, we have to explain non-thermal, right? It's non-thermal plasma. We're not creating a lot of heat. We're not utilizing a lot of energy. It's pulsing, right? It's creating these lightning shots very rapidly, but in bursts, and therefore it doesn't use much, it doesn't create much energy. So I think it's always a challenge. And then it comes downstream as the adoption side. It's okay, I get it, right? Explain to me how it's better than the next technology. Explain to me, prove it to me, show it to me in these applications. And then I draw from, if you will, common reference points. More recently, we did a presentation and I use the movie Everywhere, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we're trying to do application-wise. You're asking me to do it in high concentrations and in small volumes or hyper-concentrate. You're asking me to do it in low concentrations and super high volumes. You're asking me to do it with a landfill leachate matrix, AFFF, all these different matrices of bad stuff. So we have to do everywhere, all at once, right? And prove it. And I think that's our challenge. Have people understand it, see it, recognize it, experience it. And certainly in our case, everybody likes seeing plasma generated. It's the Tesla ball, right? That they can put their hand on and go, oh, that's what you do.
Yeah. The other dynamic beyond communication is organizational leadership. And I feel like familiar for a lot of people in Silicon Valley, where you have engineers trying to run large technology companies, and some of the challenges can be very public. I think there's some skills that are transferable from an engineering space to a leadership space, but there are also challenges. What advice would you have for engineering founders who are looking at opening up their own company, taking a concept and turning it into a business? What have you learned about some of the skills that you need in order to make that transition from engineer to leader?
Yeah, I think that is certainly another good question. I think going back very early, if you're a builder, if you're really innovating, you have to innovate with a purpose, right? Intentionality. Why are you doing it? What's the application? What's the benefit? And certainly as we create companies, we look for investors and say, where's the payback on doing that, right? There is the principle, we want to make money doing that which we do, all right? We're not all in it for a nonprofit. We are actually in it to make money. So following that money and making the business case as to why that benefits your customer and client and why will they pay you for it, what you're providing has to be the first aspect of looking at the technologies that you're developing. So are you really in a competitive space from a cost to address the problem? And then as well, do your customer, your clients understand the value that you are generating on their behalf? And certainly there's different industries. I've been involved in fire and security, and some of those are simply regulatory environments or compliance has to be there or else have other legal ramifications. PFAS is similar in that, but many cases in the majority of my career has been just simply providing the best value added to any of the customers. So we may be in a competitive environment, but we provide the best value, the best combination of price, quality, durability, effectiveness, or performance, whichever way you want to look at it. And the fact that you can answer those and check those boxes, stand behind the product, create your brand strength for doing that and being really customer focused. We used to have a concept in one of my corporations of really applying to your five major stakeholders, customers, investors, employees, the communities that you work in, and taking a look at all of those and making sure that you're providing value to each of them. And of course, the fifth being suppliers as well. They're an integral part of your supply chain.
Yeah. Let's bring in the Wet Center now. How did you get connected to them and what value add did you receive from working with one of their programs?
So the introduction is pretty straightforward. One of our investors is West Coast based and introduced us to the concept and to the Wet Center at Fresno State. And subsequently, we got involved and were accepted into a cohort. I think the number is eight, that the eighth such grouping of companies trying to bring their products, technologies, and solutions to market. And we just found the team to be super great to work with, a very structured program that wasn't just there to pontificate, but really provide value to us through enhancing the way that we not only pitch our business, but position our businesses, and then networking and introductions to investors, potential partners, and customers, opening us up in particular to probably not our first market that we'll go into, but clearly one that is going to be down the road, which is like an irrigation of crops. There's no sense using contaminated groundwater and spraying it over the crop that you're irrigating, right? So perhaps there's a treatment application right there in the agricultural center of California as well. And I'd say the last thing is, it's been a continuous and enduring relationship, so that they're constantly thinking of us and thinking of other new people that they can introduce and network us with.
I always include my podcast with book recommendations. Do you have any?
It's actually timely. A very interesting one. Quick backdrop. I went to a wedding recently where they put a book on each table for everybody at that table to read. So in other words, you found the table that you were going to sit at by looking at the spine of the book, and you went to that table. So every table had a different book to read. Our table was given Upgrade by Blake Crouch. And it's a little bit sci-fi, but to your earlier comments about, hey, wading through a very technically challenging concept or theme, this one is about DNA and DNA splicing and CRISPR technologies and splicer and all this about upgrading a human. And I think that it is certainly one of those great ones. As technologists, innovators, you always have to sit back and contemplate the hubris of which you approach a problem. And certainly, do you really understand the long-term effects of what it is you're doing and the knock-ons that you can't even contemplate? And I think that even with the business that we're in, I think back to those smart scientists and engineers that came up with PFAS compounds for the betterment of all the products that it was applied to, that I can assure you did not want to cause harm to anybody and the environment and to bioaccumulate and such. That wasn't why they approached it. That's not why they solved the problem. But yet, unbeknownst, it did. Right? And then how do you unravel that? And how do those companies at some point grapple with what they created? So I thought it was just an appropriate one. It's a good read. It is a little bit of a challenge because you're introduced to all these DNA technologies that I have no idea about, but it tells a good story in the process and certainly a great moral dilemma that needs to be thought through for any innovator. It's the old, yes, we can, but should we?
Yeah, I've become a recent science fiction convert myself. I always thought it was just too complex or too out there. But then I realized that science fiction is just a laboratory for ideas set in other places. And so once I figured that out, I've been spiraling on my science fiction. Part of my bookshelf is filling up quickly. And when I first read about your technology, Ken, it seemed like something out of a sci-fi novel of some kind. And I'm so happy that it exists because it's a huge problem that we need to address. And I'm so glad that there's people like you that are approaching it from innovation standpoint. I think there's only so much we can control downstream to some of the effects. And sometimes we just need downstream solutions to address things immediately. And I'm excited for the future. Now, for people that are interested in learning more about the company and the technology, where can they go?
I appreciate that, Jordan. I think really the easiest place is just go to our website at dmaxplasma.com. We're going to be upgrading that as well and refreshing it with some new content. But a lot of our published literature is out there, as well as some great animation on how the process works. And certainly you can contact us there as well if you want to learn more.
Perfect. Thank you so much for talking with me, Ken.
I appreciate it, Jordan. Thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.